You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, and despite not adding one single penny to the national debt and having a $2.5 trillion surplus, you know what I'm talking about, Social Security, President Obama put it on the table, Social Security insurance on the table, moving the so-called fiscal cliff negotiations even deeper into Republican home turf. This is grim. Think about it. We're debating just how many rich people will get to keep George W. Bush's tax cuts. We're debating just how many seniors, poor people, and disabled people are going to suffer when their Social Security insurance is cut. We're debating which social welfare programs will expire. That's the kind of debate you'd expect to see between a center-left Republican and a far-right Republican. Right? That's the debate that you should have between, you know, Dwight Eisenhower and Barry Goldwater, not between a Democrat and a Republican. When the debate is about, you know, how much are we going to extend tax cuts to rich people? How much are we going to cut Social Security or Medicare? Republicans are going to win every time, and the working class gets screwed every time. Instead, and I hope you'll help me inform him, and to those of you at the White House who are listening, please pay careful attention. President Obama should be putting progressive solutions on the table. Things like a STET tax, the securities transaction excise tax, a financial transaction tax. It could reduce the debt by maybe as much as $1.8 trillion over the next decade. Or cutting off taxpayer subsidies to big oil, $40 billion. Or ending the massive capital gains loophole, which sets income taxes on hedge fund managers and vulture capitalists like Mitt Romney at a stupid maximum of 15%, which is half of what working people can pay. Or common sense cuts to our bloated and wasteful defense budget. Have you heard any discussion about any of this? No! How about raising the minimum wage to stimulate the economy and thus increase tax collections, which would reduce our debt? Heard anybody suggest that? I don't think so. How about breaking up the big banks so that we don't have any costly deficit expanding bailouts in the future? I mean, you just had a bank that was convicted of supporting terrorists in the Middle East who did 9/11 and narco terrorists in Mexico. And did they go to Guantanamo? No. Did they get hit with a drone? No. They paid a little fine. It was just the cost of business. Why? Because they're too big to fail. The hell they are. They are not too big to fail. And beyond that, sending most of their senior executives to prison would not kill the bank. How about creating a single-payer health care system to cut in half the health insurance costs or the health care costs in the United States, put them in line with the rest of the developed world? Why are we discussing these things? You know, if all these things were on the table, there could be an actual debate that genuinely reflects the political leanings of this nation, which is a center-left nation. More than half of all Americans, in most cases more than 60, 70, 80% of all Americans, want Social Security strengthened, not weakened, benefits raised, not cut, cost of living adjustments, you know, more accurately reflecting inflation, not less, want Medicare strengthened and expanded, not cut or voucherized. But none of that stuff is part of the discussion right now, which shows not just the weakness of President Obama, but, and it pains me to say this, the weakness of the progressive movement when compared with the hard right movement, which is funded by cranky billionaires like the Koch brothers and Sheldon Adelson, which takes us to the five wackadoodles on the Supreme Court. But don't get me started on that. Labor unions, which have historically been the vanguard of the progressive movement, are crippled. Right? Ronald Reagan kneecapped them. Independent media, print, radio, television, you name it, used to carry the voices of average working people, local stations all across America. They've been bankrupted and sold off to large corporate media outlets that pump out lies and misinformation that promote the billionaire's agenda. They call it right-wing talk radio and Fox so-called news. Well, actually, network news. What can you say? Let's talk about Casey Anthony. Yeah, that's important. Essentially, the progressive counterbalances in America, which for several generations kept in check the corporatists who wanted to destroy FDR's New Deal, and that held the Democratic Party in line, those balancing forces are largely gone. When Reagan busted PATCO in 81, he didn't just kick off a three-decade-long assault on labor unions. He also kicked off a three-decade-long assault on a once-progressive Democratic Party. Remember, if some of you are old enough to remember Lyndon Johnson's Democratic Party. I mean, we were very upset with him about the war. But this guy cut poverty in half in the United States. Created a not just an African American middle class, but in many parts of the United States where there was a lot of poverty among white people, a new white middle class. You know, help just like I was going to say the progressive Eisenhower. He was just, you know, Eisenhower was in today's parlance, I guess, a radical progressive Democrat. But back then, he was a moderate Republican, and he built a middle class. And so did Lyndon Johnson. And that tradition seems to have died. This all-out assault on the American middle class, which is being led full charge, full-throated, full bore, you know, riding down the street in their chariots, by the Koch brothers and Shelley Adelson and Karl Rove. I mean, just those three. Just those three spent over $500 million in the last election. You know how much John McCain spent in the entire election of 2008, the John McCain campaign? $600 million. Maybe almost seven. Just those three people spent $500 million. I mean, tell me this isn't just completely out of control. This assault is now reaching its peak. Republicans, and here's the proof of it. You got right-wing Republicans and President Obama sitting down like they're at Thanksgiving dinner, getting ready to carve up the turkey of the New Deal in Social Security insurance. Yeah, let's shave a little off here with a change CPI. Let's shave a little off here with, you know, come on. And they're doing it because there is no counterbalance. It's not there. I mean, there used to be that the unions were the counterbalance. They were strong. It used to be that just common sense in America was the counterbalance. It was strong. It was echoed in the media. It used to be that the weekend shows didn't just show the inside the beltway cognoscenti, you know? But then the creep toward the political right began. And it's continuing relentlessly. President Obama has given in to the Republicans over and over and over again. And if we want to do something about that, we need to remind him that he's the president. He's armed with a bully pulpit. He's no longer facing re-election. He's free to be true to his progressive community organizing roots. There's still hope. FDR didn't campaign on bringing revolutionary change to America in 1932. He was forced to do it by a nation suffering through a Great Depression and radicalized by the damage done to us by millionaires and banksters. The New Deal was in part a response to occupations, Hoovervilles, and a genuine sense of outrage across America about the looting of our country by the very rich. Today we have, it's weak, but it's there, the Occupy movement. You got organized labor, they're weak, but they're there. You got the environmental movement, it's growing. We're beginning to build a progressive base that can counter the billionaires' money. We're not strong enough yet, obviously, to push the White House in the direction we need to. But that day may come, and you and I need to make it sooner instead of later.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? The billionaires or the people?
I'm gonna stand.
At least I'm standing my ground right here. And I know that, you know, good Democrats in the House of Representatives like Jan Schakowsky are standing their ground, and good Democrats in the Senate and independents in the Senate like Bernie Sanders are standing their ground, people like Sherrod Brown. But why is it that the White House, I'll just tell you a story. I was talking with a friend of mine last night who is a Democratic consultant. And I said, it's got to be that these leaks that are coming out, that the White House is thinking of doing a change CPI, that they're thinking about, you know, basically cutting Social Security to the tune of, you know, over the next 15 years, about $6,000 a year. Not a year, $6,000 in total over a 15-year period, excuse me. You know, it's got to be that these leaks are coming from the Republicans trying to push Obama. And this friend of mine said, no, I was on a conference call today with the White House, and they're talking about how do we message this thing. I'm like, are you kidding? Are you crazy? How do Democrats message cutting Social Security? There's no way. I'll tell you how to message it. Get away from it. Somebody needs to remind the Democratic Party that Jude Wininsky pointed out back in the 70s that the strength of the Democratic Party has always been that they were Santa Claus. Now, they, you know, we paid for our own presence. We chip in for unemployment insurance. We chip in for workers' comp, workman's comp. We chip in for Social Security. We pay for Medicare. We pay for it, but we want it. These are programs that help keep America strong. Unemployment insurance. The minimum wage. I mean, just practical stuff. Regulations of our banks. So that they go back to being the nice, boring old business they used to be instead of gambling casinos. Why is it that the Democratic Party is, is not in, at least in the negotiations, right? You're going to negotiate with John Boehner. And he comes to the table and he says, we want to cut Social Security, we want to cut Medicare, and we want to cut unemployment insurance. And instead of, what Democrats should be saying is, okay, we understand you want to do that. We want to raise the minimum wage to $10 an hour. We want to raise tariffs from the average 2% right now to 15%, pretty much across the board on manufactured goods, or put into place a VAT tax. We want to raise trillions of dollars of income with a STET tax, the Robin Hood tax, so-called, a securities transaction excise tax, a tax on every single stock transaction made every single day, every minute, which we did from 1896 until 1964. It worked just fine, thank you very much. And most European countries have it right now. We want to break up the big banks on Wall Street. We want to lower the retirement age from 65 to 62 for both Medicare and Social Security. It'll take people out of the workplace and open up jobs for young people who will be making more money and paying more taxes, which will strengthen the programs. We want to make education free in the United States all the way to the level of PhD so that we can have that same renaissance in the decade following when we do it that we had back in the 50s and 60s as a result, or, you know, arguably, yeah, the mid-50s through the mid-70s that we had as the result of sending a generation of young men to college after they came back from World War II on the GI Bill. We want to cut our health expenses in the United States in half while making sure that everybody has health insurance, and we want to do that by getting Stephen Jay Hemsley and the United Healthcare and these other health insurance companies out of the business. Let them go into the business like they do in other developed countries of you know, offering five-star rooms with catered meals and you know, a concierge surgery services for the very, very rich. That's fine. Let them, you know, they can, there's still a place, a niche business for insurance companies. But the foundation of our health insurance system, that's nuts. So we put all this stuff on the table and we say, okay, John Boehner, let's talk about the minimum wage. Because we want to stimulate the economy and raise taxes, thus, or raise tax revenues by stimulating the economy. Okay, John Boehner, let's talk about cutting our health costs, healthcare costs in this country in half. And about, you know, about 20, 25% of them are paid for by the federal government. So it's really important that we do that. Okay, Boehner, you want to cut Social Security, Medicare, I get it. You want to cut unemployment, I get it. You want to screw poor people, you want to cut food stamps, I get it. Let's have a conversation first, though, about closing 20% of America's bases around the world. There's not even 700 countries in the world. What are we doing with over 700 military bases overseas? There are a lot of ways we can save a lot of money. You want to just do it all in cuts? Fine. Start with the money going to the health insurance company. Start with Medicare. Go to Medicare and say, from now on, Medicare can negotiate with drug companies just like the Veterans Administration does, just like Walgreens does, just like Walmart does. You want some cuts? Fine. We'll cut Medicare. We'll cut out the waste and fraud that is represented by that legislation that Republican Billy Towson put in back during the Bush administration, Medicare Part D, that says that it's illegal for the federal government to negotiate drug prices, that if you buy an aspirin, you got to pay the full $5 retail per pill, rather than say, Gene, we're buying 5 million aspirin this year. Give them to us for, you know, a dozen of them for a penny, which is, you know, probably what the wholesale cost is. You get my point? Am I making sense here, or am I just, have I just lost it altogether? America is a center-left nation. We want these things. We will vote for these things.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And you can go to callcongress.org and get the president's phone number and Congress's phone number and call them up and say that you want them too. Hey, let's negotiate some real stuff here. Find the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And this week, this one week, I'm going to mention this every day. We are raising funds, raising money for the, and asking you to be a supporter and a participant with the Hunter School and the New England Salem Children's Village. Hunterschool.org is their website. You can see what they're doing, who they are. Their history, SalemChildren'sVillage.org also, you know, about that aspect of their work. And here's just a little clip of from one of the kids who talks about learning how to use this kind of positive visualization to overcome some pretty severe obsessive compulsive behavior. Here she is.
The Hunter School is a great place of opportunities, and it helps kids by whatever their needs are, and it just shows a lot of help and support that you need, and they'll do anything to help you, and they're just really open and nice. I'm doing a lot of weight light, and I'm learning probably things that I wouldn't have learned in my old schools. I wouldn't have learned how to contain myself and not let negativity get to me. And just break my habits and stuff. I have trichotillomania, and it causes me to pull my hair. And I'm trying to break that habit by getting a reward of singing music.
So give them a call at 603-786-9427 or go to hunterschool.org or salemchildrensvillage.org. So much need in this world, you know? There is so much need in this world. And the president is not putting it on the negotiating table. How about, you know, no charity in America should be having to beg for money. it's like we should be funding the needs of our children in this country. Instead, I mean, it's like, you know, why is the Salvation Army standing out in front of Macy's? Well, yeah, I mean, in part, I get it. They're an evangelical Christian organization, and they need to fund their efforts as well. But why do we have poverty in the United States? Our productivity is among the highest in the world. Our people work more hours every year than any other people in the world. We generate more wealth than any other country in the world. Where did all that money go? Oh, that's right. The top 1% have seen a 275% increase in their wealth since Ronald Reagan's presidency. And the rest of us, You know, the bottom 80% have seen bupkis. In fact, the bottom 40, 50% have seen their wages go down. Put that on the table, Mr. President. And I mean that respectfully. I really believe that President Obama has in his heart that he knows what needs to be done, that he's been there, he knows it. You can't separate people from their upbringing. He has seen, you know, his mother was struggling to pay health insurance bills when she was dying of cancer, fighting with the health insurance company over what they'd pay for, which is probably why he worked so hard for that national health care plan, for Obamacare. It's a good step. But when John Boehner comes to you and says, well, let's cut Social Security, let's put a change CPI in there so that over time people get less and less from Social Security, you should shove it down his throat. Kick him out of the room, go to the microphone and say, well, the Republicans have made a stupid offer. Here's my counter offer. We're going to forgive all student debt in this country. We're going to encourage people to go to college. We're going to end all federal funding for for-profit schools, only not-for-profit schools and state schools, and we're going to double the funding that we're giving to them. And we're going to educate a generation of Americans. And we're not going to educate them that the world is 3,000 years old and men, you know, walked with dinosaurs. Sorry. Which, you know, and I say that because that's the consequence of voucherizing public education. The biggest beneficiaries of this whole voucherize, you know, charter school, blah de blah, are the Christian schools. And I'm reluctant to even call them Christian schools because I call myself a Christian and I don't recognize these people. It's the fundamentalist crazies. It's the Christian Taliban schools who are the biggest beneficiaries. I'm still waiting for the Taliban to open a charter school in the United States. Then maybe Americans would realize, you know, you really want to be funding that? No, we don't want to fund a Taliban school. Well, you're doing the same thing right down the street. They just call themselves Christians. They want to keep women in their place. They're xenophobic. Enough of that rant. Let's get into the conversation about this. Judy in Brighton, Colorado. Hey, Judy, thanks for listening to AM 760.
Yes, I am so irate. My heart is pounding, and I hope I can get my thoughts out. I'm 73 years old. I have voted Democratic since I was 21. That's 52 years. This year, I walked over 18 hours, even though I'm 73, for the Democrats. I was an election judge that worked over 17 hours to make sure the election ran smooth. I've given money. I am so irate over this consumer price index thing, I can hardly stand it. I have already called Nancy Pelosi's office. I have received my Social Security cost of living thing for 2013. I am going to receive $19 extra a month. $5 is taken out for my Medicare, so that gives me $14 a month. This consumer price index is low. They should be raising it, not lowering it.
Yep.
All of my bills have increased more than $14 a month. And what was very interesting, when I called the White House this morning, I was talking to the comment line, and this woman was obviously a senior, and I told her about the consumer price index, and she says, oh, really? She says, I didn't know that. And she says, that's really disturbing. And I says, you need to call the president.
Yeah, well, you're there in the White House. Go over and,
yeah, and she laughed.
Give him an earful.
She says, I just might do that. And she says, I want you to know that I wrote down everything that you said.
Good. Good on you.
And I want to tell you the other thing is if this passes, I am out of there. I am not a Democrat anymore. I will leave the Democratic Party after 52 years.
I am very concerned, Judy, that if the president keeps negotiating with Republicans on Republican talking points, and that is what the debate is limited to, and traditional Democratic talking points, traditional Democratic priorities never get even on the table for debate, that the Democratic Party is not going to regain the House of Representatives in 2 years, they may not even continue to control the Senate, and that the president will be effectively neutered by the Republicans. I am so concerned. They have put him in this box, and he seems like, you know, he's happy there. And I'm wretched about it. Judy, thank you for the call.
That is one of the points that I made when I called the White House and when I called Nancy Pelosi, that they are going to lose 2014.
Yeah, they absolutely are. And there's a great piece over on Daily Kos, Marcos. Judy, thank you for the call. Marcos Melitzos goes into the president thinks maybe he thinks he won because he compromised with the Republicans. Actually, you look at the public opinion polls, whenever he compromised with the Republicans, his popularity went down, not up. Whenever he fought with the Republicans, when John Boehner started digging his heels in, when they took us to the fiscal cliff, the president's popularity went up, not down. It's time to take names and kick butt. It's not time to sit around and say, oh, yeah, let's work out something. Let's kumbaya. Let's all be happy. No. You know, Clinton did that, and what did he do? He killed welfare, and as a result, I mean, it was no problem when we were in a boom time, but now that we're in a bust time, there's a lot of people hurting because Bill Clinton caved into the Republicans. We shouldn't be doing it again. Dan in Bowling Brook, Illinois. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. Just a thought on the fiscal cliff. I mean, before the president even starts negotiating, he should have pointed out, you know, there's a couple non-starters, and you touched on the one with the Medicare Part D. I mean, it's so obvious that should be changed in for the money savings. No businessman would go for that.
Right.
And for like good faith, to close the loopholes for these tax breaks on the oil companies. They certainly don't need it.
Yeah.
And another big one, I think, and these are all points that the average voter, the low information voter that doesn't listen to you to learn these things would be, they need to fix this pension thing with the post office.
Yeah.
Because there's not a business professor in the country that would say that was good business. And if it was a publicly held company, there would already be class action lawsuits against the board of directors for doing it.
For doing something so stupid as to fund retirement benefits 75 years into the future for people who haven't even been born yet and put the entire institution at risk by doing so. But that's what the Republicans forced through Congress in 2006 in order to cripple the post office.
But those are great talking points, though. The president could bring up and say, look, before we talk about more compromise, these things have to get fixed first. And there's not a voter in the country that's going to go, that's a bad idea.
No, but there's 36,000 lobbyists in this town. I mean, just the gun industry, just the NRA spent $19 million last year lobbying in this town. And you got Wayne LaPierre taking his $1 million a year salary to promote gun violence. I mean, it's just... This country, this town, Washington, D.C., and this country in general has been taken over by a madness called money. And it was facilitated by the U.S. Supreme Court, which is a whole nother rant. But and you know where that's going. Dan, thank you for the call. If anybody needs to be neutered, it's the Supreme Court. It's time to say enough, guys. Read Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
The Supreme Court is supposed to behave in ways as regulated by the U.S. Congress. It's time for the Congress to say, sorry, guys, you can't tell us that money is the same thing as speech anymore. Bad and the very, very contumaciously ugly, the good. Orleans Parish, Louisiana. The Orleans Parish School District voted on Wednesday to ban any school textbooks and curriculum that teach popular pseudoscience like creationism. The ban also prevents the teaching, by popular, by the way, I mean like as in pop. The ban also prevents the teaching of hard right ideas such as whether or not slavery was real. The move by Orleans Parish is in direct response to Texas education guidelines, which openly allow the teaching of creationism, climate change denial, and phony history. If America is going to be able to compete with the global community in the months and years to come, we need to have the brightest, most well-educated children in the world, not the most misinformed. Let's hope more school districts across the country kick pseudoscience out of the classroom once and for all. Pseudoscience, aka religion. The bad. Florida's stand-your-ground law. Man in Florida is using that state's so-called Stand Your Ground law as a defense for shooting a customer who was complaining about slow service at a fast food restaurant in St. Petersburg. Victim was waiting in line and started complaining about the service. The alleged shooter got in an argument with a complaining customer, and after the argument got heated, he pulled out a gun and shot a couple times. Fortunately, no one was seriously injured, although this guy did take two bullets to the stomach. This is just another example of why Stand Your Ground laws are so absurd and so dangerous. They promote more gun violence, and it's time they were overturned. And the very, very ugly Stafford Jones. Jones, the Republican Party chair in Alachua County, Florida, has admitted that Republicans in the Sunshine State intentionally tried to suppress the votes of that state's college students in last month's election. In an interview with a local paper, Jones accused liberals of bringing in students to Florida to swing the election. Jones's admission comes after other Florida Republican officials openly acknowledged that voter suppression efforts were directed at preventing Democratic voters from voting. Hopefully, Democrats can prevent this kind of election rigging from happening again in 2016, because preventing thousands of college students and citizens from voting is very, very ugly. It's incredibly ugly. Henry in Osceola, Arkansas. Hey, Henry, what's up?
All right, how are you doing today?
I'm fine. You wanted to talk about Social Security.
Yeah, I'm really frustrated here. You know, I have my great-grandmother, my grandmother, my father, when he retired, all of them got on Social Security and stuff, you know, because these are things they paid into the system. And I've seen a lot of my great-grandmother, my grandmother friends who were actually living on dog food to manage the finances to the next check because they were just able to work because of the hard labor they'd done.
Right.
Now, how, as a society, we put up with these Republicans to sit up there and demand cuts? It may not cut like right now, but it's going to be a projective cut. The longer they live, the less money they get. Yep. How much sense does that make? Because when you're older and you live longer, the cost of living goes up.
Yep. It's insane. That's why it's called Republican logic. It is just plain old, flat-out nuts. It is wrong, and the president needs to say no. And I would suggest strongly, Henry, that you and anybody else who's watching or listening to me go to callcongress.org. The White House comment line phone number is there, and the phone number for the main switchboard of Congress is there. If you don't know who your member of the House of Representatives is, just give me your zip code. They'll tell you. If you're not sure who your two senators are, just tell them what state you live in. They will tell you, and they will not only tell you, they will connect you with the office. You can call that, you know, call the Congress. You can call the White House. The numbers are right there at callcongress.org. The White House's number is 202-456-1111. And, you know, just give them a call and say, you know, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. This is nuts. It's time for Democrats to start negotiating like Democrats, not like Republicans. Henry, thank you for the call. How the president could say, okay, yeah, let's debate Republican, you know, The hardcore Republicans versus the moderate Republicans. Let's debate in that spectrum rather than how about the American spectrum, which is all the way from progressives to conservatives. I don't get it. Jay in Sumner, Washington. Hey, Jay, the Progressive Party, yeah. Really?
Yeah, Tom. I'm mad as hell about all this, too. Obama, from his past track record the last 4 years, has been like he's two dogs. Is there anybody on our side anymore?
Well, you know, first of all, instead of trashing the Blue Dogs are a local phenomenon. They're not a national thing. I mean, there's a national movement. But the point is that I would rather have, in a district where all the voters think that they're Republicans, I would rather have them elect a Democrat who half the time behaves like a Republican than elect a Republican. Because the most important vote that a member of Congress makes in their entire time in Congress is that first vote that's taken on the first day that the House is gaveled into session in the Senate, which is the vote for the leadership. Who's going to be in charge here? And they literally, I mean, they it could be that they even select somebody who's not their party, but they don't. But, you know, so I would rather have Democrats than Republicans. This is one of the problems we have right now. Not, you know, more than half of America voted to put Democrats in charge of the U.S. House of Representatives, yet more than half of the members of the House of Representatives are Republicans because they successfully gerrymandered these state districts. So, you know, the Blue Dogs are a group that are, you know, if they weren't there, you would have Republicans. I would rather have Blue Dog Democrats.
Yeah. Perhaps it's time for the progressive movement to start getting organized for 2016.
Yes, sir.
Either that or maybe Thomas Jefferson was right. It's time. It's time.
Well, Jefferson didn't say we need a revolution every 20 years. That was Sharon Engel badly distorting what he said. What he said was that the Constitution should be revisited every generation, which he defined as 19 years. He said, and he thought that there should be a constitutional convention or an easier process to amend the Constitution because time changes and things change. He said and his metaphor was, he said, you wouldn't expect a man to wear the same clothing that he wore as a child. And, you know, this was the birth of the nation. It was a young nation. And I don't disagree with him altogether. On the other hand, given how the billionaires have taken over, I'm very reluctant to open the Constitution up for tinkering. Jay, thanks a lot for the call. But, yeah, it is time to begin preparing for 2014 right now. And that means showing up at the Democratic Party headquarters and saying, I'm here, I'm progressive, and I want to take over. Or I want to be a part of this. I want my voice in this. I want to be part of this thing that is happening. See, we just had a vote. People think voting is enough. It's only the beginning.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, let me lay this thing out really simply. At the end of the year, all the Bush tax cuts expire. So do Obama's cuts to the Social Security payroll tax, the 2% cut. So, you know, working people will see their Social Security or their payroll tax go up by 2%, as it was up until a year and a half or so ago. And, by the way, that helps fund Social Security, so it's a good thing that tax goes back where it was. If we want to put that, you know, up to $2,000 a year for somebody making $110,000 a year, if we want to put that back into their paychecks, give them 2% tax credit. That's easy. But in any case, those tax cuts are going to go. They're going to go away. Let them go. Now, what is the advantage to the president of negotiating with John Boehner? My understanding of the Democratic argument, big D, Democratic Party argument, is that there are two advantages to the president negotiating with Boehner now. One is that if he can get Boehner to call for a vote and he can get the Republicans or even a small handful of them, enough that along with the Democrats it passes in the House of Representatives, to pass a tax cut for average working people that doesn't include a tax cut for millionaires and billionaires, effectively that's a tax hike and Grover Norquist's head will explode. That's one benefit. In other words, the president will look like he won something to the low information voters in America who decide elections. The second reason, and perhaps this is the more important one, is that sometime in the spring, the federal government is going to run out of borrowing authority. We won't be able to pay our bills anymore. Doesn't mean we can't. We could easily raise taxes. I mean, America's an incredibly wealthy nation. We have, you know, $60, $70, $80 trillion worth of wealth in this country. It's mind-boggling. You know, some people think that the wealth of the United States is well over $100 trillion if you include things that aren't, you know, quantifiable as part of the business and governmental infrastructure of the country. What is the value of the Grand Canyon? So it's not like, you know, we're going broke. We're not. It's not like we're in trouble. We're not. It's not like we can't borrow money. We can easily. In fact, interest rates have never been lower, or not in my lifetime. Maybe they were when I was born or something, you know, in 1951, but they're not now. I mean, they're that low now. They're not high now. But there's this ceiling, this debt ceiling. And Boehner says, we'll take that off the table for a year if you'll play nice with us now. Well, first of all, I don't believe the man. He's a liar. Secondly, and more importantly, the debt ceiling is not, you know, the Republicans are going to try and tell you that raising the debt ceiling means the president can spend more money. It doesn't. Raising the debt ceiling does not authorize a single penny of additional expenditures in the United States. Instead, what it authorizes is that we pay the bills that the Republicans have already run up. With George Bush's war in Iraq, George Bush's war in Afghanistan, George Bush's massive tax cut for millionaires and billionaires, and George Bush's addition of pharmaceuticals to Medicare as Part D, forcing the government not to negotiate or forbidding the government, saying to Medicare employees, if you try to negotiate with the drug companies and get a better deal and lower prices, you go to jail. Or you get fired at the very least. Okay, so all raising the debt ceiling does is it lets Congress, or lets the executive branch actually makes the payments. Congress authorizes them. Congress authorizes the executive branch to pay its bills. Bills that were run up by Congress. Mostly by Republicans in Congress. And the Republicans are saying, we're gonna invoke this 1917 law, this so-called debt ceiling, that says that Congress has to authorize itself, it has to authorize the executive branch to pay the bills that Congress already incurred. Well, let me read to you from the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution. This is the fourth article, fourth section of the 14th Amendment. Now, keep in mind, what the Republicans are saying is what the debt ceiling does, not the Republicans, here, what the debt ceiling does is it prevents us from paying our bills, bills that have already been run up. Services already delivered. We already bought that F-35. Now we have to pay Boeing or Fairchild or whoever makes it. I don't know. And if the Republicans say, no, we're not going to negotiate with you, then they don't get paid. In other words, the full faith and credit of the United States is called into question. We're deadbeats. That's what the debt ceiling is all about. If we hit the debt ceiling, we become deadbeats. Section 4. This is the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution. This is the Constitution. This is the highest law of the land. The validity of the public debt of the United States authorized by law, including debts incurred for payment of pensions and bounties for services in suppressing insurrection or rebellion, shall not be questioned. You get that? Shall not be questioned. But the Republicans want to stand on the floor of the House of Representatives and say, we question whether we can pay these bills. We're invoking the debt ceiling. All Obama has to do is say, I'm going to direct the Treasury Department to pay these damn bills. And if you guys don't like it, sue me. And 2 years from now, we'll have this fight in front of the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court, I realize the Supreme Court's pretty good at twisting themselves in pretzels to give right-wingers what they want. Look at Citizens United. Look at Heller and McDonald. Look at the decisions that said that in the Second Amendment, which says, in order to maintain a well-regulated militia, that being necessary for the freedom of a free state or the security of a free state or whatever the phrase is, the right to bear arms, blah de blah. Somehow in that, you know, having a free state because we have a well-regulated militia, somehow in that they discovered this little gem that says that you as an individual have a right to own an AR-15. Really? Now, I get it that the Supreme Court has twisted the Constitution in knots over and over and over again throughout its history, which is why they never should have been. You know, Jefferson in 1803, when they took the power to do that in the Marbury versus Madison case, Jefferson should have jumped down their throat. He tried to verbally. He didn't have a legal basis to do it, though, because he'd won the case. And they didn't do it again until 20 years after he was out of office, 30 years, 40 years after he was out of office. The second time that they did it was Dred Scott, 1856. Thomas Jefferson had been dead for 30 years, nearly 30 years. But in any case, the president can simply say, debt ceiling, I can't think of something that's onomatopoeia, you know. Debt ceiling mushmealing or something, you know. There's got to be some cute saying that he could say that's the equivalent of, you know, put it where the sun doesn't shine. And we're going to pay the bills. You guys don't like it. Sue me. It's just that simple. He could do that. The debt ceiling is unconstitutional. But instead, what's happening is that we're having this debate on the Republican talking points. How much are we going to cut taxes for millionaires? How much are we going to cut benefits for working people? How much are we going to devastate people who are handicapped? That's a third of Social Security payments. How much are we going to do that? How are we going to cut Social Security? Instead of saying, oh, let's raise the minimum wage. Let's strengthen the power of labor unions with a card check law. Let's change our insane trade policies. Let's have a national health care system which will almost cut in half our medical expenses so we'll be in line with the rest of the developed world. Let's lower the retirement age for Social Security and Medicare, which will take people out of the workplace, which will open up jobs for young people, which will raise wages because it'll increase the pressure for more jobs. And by raising wages, we will increase tax revenues. We'll grow our way out of the deficit the same way Eisenhower did it.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, the Democrats think we can't talk about those things because we got to worry about the debt ceiling.
No, you don't! Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you, and my old friend Marianne Williamson is on the line. She's a speaker, the author of 10 books, including A Return to Love and the forthcoming The Law of Divine Compensation. Her website, marianne.com. Marianne, welcome back to the program. It's been a long time since we've talked.
Oh, thank you, Tom. I'm your biggest fan.
Oh, thank you. It is great to have, and I am yours.
Thank you, darling.
Tell me about the Shift Network and the Agape International Spiritual Center. This gig that's happening, Birth 2012, that you're going to be speaking at.
Well, you know, they're doing this big event here in Los Angeles because so many people all over the world are quite jazzed about this idea of humanity ending one era, you know, according to the Mayan calendar, and beginning the next. For me personally, I think the level of ultimate reality is beyond linear time anyway, so I'm not sure that any particular date on the calendar matters in that sense. But I think the very fact that people are embracing the thought that humanity could be entering a new era is a good thing. And the idea of an era of peace and an era of human beings organizing our civilization according to more enlightened principles. So I think whether there is an objective reality to this idea of the change from one era into another, or if it's just conceptual, it almost doesn't matter.
I agree.
That's good.
The website, by the way, is birth2012la, as in Los Angeles, .com, birth2012la.com. And we're talking with Marianne Williamson, marianne.com. And Marianne, I would love your thoughts on this. It seems to me like some people, apparently this young man who murdered these children in Connecticut. His mother was called herself a prepper. These people, they're a prepper. They are, we used to call them survivalists. Now they call themselves preppers. They are preparing for the collapse of civilization. I call it the full Glenn Beck. And there's this subculture in America of people who are like, they see change as being doom, gloom, and disaster. And this is why she was taking her son out and teaching him how to use an semi-automatic machine gun, basically, you know, this Bushmaster. And on the other hand, you've got people who see change coming, like you and the people who are going to be at birth2012la.com this weekend, Friday and Saturday. And we're going to have an end of the world party here on the show on Friday, because it's not going to end. It's going to be it's a time for change. View these milestones or moments as opportunities to step up, to step forward, to let the light in. What's the difference?
Well, the difference is not so much between those two theories or ways of viewing the world. That difference is obvious. What's different in terms of American history is we've always had nuts. We've always had crazy people. We've always had people who represented extreme views. The difference is that today they have political platforms as never before.
Yeah.
So the idea of our gun laws, for instance, things like that, which so many of our political policies represent views which, yes, we're America, we're not a monolith, people have the opportunity, it's a free society, to take all kinds of, you know, viewpoints and take them seriously. But the interesting thing from a psychological and spiritual perspective is that those who hate with conviction. And those who have more enlightened views do not display the same kind of conviction. And that's the problem that we have. People who hate, people who have the most negative, regressive views, are turning those views into genuine force, political force, social force. And those of us who love, and you certainly cannot be seen in this category, I think you are one of the mighty exceptions. Those of us who love and try to hold more enlightened views tend to be perhaps a little more casual about it than we should be. And I think that's why this is such an important moment. I think even with the shooting at the elementary school, Americans are waking up. We're coming out of our denial here.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I just want to say we will not end a culture of violence until and unless we proactively commit to the creation of a culture of peace. Those of us who want more peaceful policies, those of us who want to be about the beginning of new possibilities rather than preparing for the death of humanity, we need to be expressing ourselves in more powerful and effective political and social ways.
Yeah. I remember many years ago you're making a comment to the effect of, and I don't remember if this was in public or if it was over dinner, but it's something to the effect of you have before you fear or love or hate or love,
mm-hmm.
And you have to choose one or the other.
Well, yes, absolutely. Every thought from a metaphysical perspective is either host to love or hostage to fear. And the main point there is that no thought is neutral. And I think that has to do with where our society is today. We've tried to be neutral. Most people say, well, I'm not hurting anybody. I'm not living my life to collaborate in a great adventure of that, all that is good, true, and beautiful, but I'm not out to hurt anybody. Well, just not being out to hurt anybody isn't enough anymore.
Mm.
We must proactively seek to create a world that is in line with the love in our hearts.
Very, very well said. And so Friday, the end of the world, this Friday, 12/21/12, mm-hmm. and the following day, Saturday, in Los Angeles. If you're in Los Angeles, you want to drop by Marianne Williamson, Barbara Marks Hubbard, a bunch of who's also a good friend. Birth2012LA.com is the website. Who else is going to be there? What's going to be going on, Marianne?
I think pretty much the usual suspects in terms of Barbara Marks Hubbard and Deepak and myself and all those, and of course all mm-hmm. the people joined socially throughout the world. I want to talk for a moment, if I might, on the kind of metaphysics of the whole notion of an Armageddon, if
mm-hmm.
I might.
Yeah, we have about 40 seconds.
Yeah, because a lot of this about Armageddon is the end of the world. Well, if you look at that from a metaphysical perspective, everybody faces their own Armageddon. For some people, it's divorce. For some, it's bankruptcy. For some, it's a diagnosis of a life-challenging illness. It's where you are faced with the choice for how you're going to live your life. If enough people learn from our own Armageddons and pass over into a more peaceful and loving way of being, and we pool those resources, then the world will not have to manifest a collective catastrophe. If we learn from our own personal end of the world, it's the end of that world, it's the end of the way I had been living my life. If enough of us go through those personal crises and we become together collaboratively and synergistically the people we're capable of being, we will not have to live through an end of world catastrophe. And that's the choice I think that lies before us now.
That is absolutely brilliant. And if you want to hear more and see Marianne Williamson, check out birth2012la.com and marianne.com for more information. Marianne, great to have you on.
Always. Thank you so much, Tom. Keep up the good work.
Thanks, Marianne. Give my very best, everybody.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
27 minutes past the hour. Okay, it was a nice break from my rant about, why are the Democrats going to... We'll get back to my rant right after this.
Just hear us say that.
Happy holidays. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. We are fundraising for the Hunter School, hunterschool.org. In particular, in addition to, just regular donations, you can go to the website, hunterschool.org, and click on the link that'll take you to the donate button and donate by PayPal or credit card. But in addition to that, they need a couple of vehicles, and I've mentioned this the last couple of days. Nobody has stepped up so far to say, yeah, I've got a car that I don't use anymore, I don't need anymore, and Hunter School will arrange to get it to them in New Hampshire, wherever you may be. But it has to be at least a 2005 model. It has to have fewer than 75,000 miles on it,
and be able to pay. And it must have all-wheel drive or four-wheel drive. And so I realize that, you know, limits the pool of cars available and therefore the number of people. But if you have such a vehicle and you'd like to donate it, the Hunter School could use it a lot right now, as well as your contributions at this holiday season. This is just a great organization. It's a really, really great organization. Rob in Mountain View, Minnesota. Hey, Rob.
I'm out in Iron, Minnesota. Okay, yes, sir. I'm fine, Tom. It's where I actually got to talk to Louise yesterday. It was great, you know. I mean, the whole thing is I called up really late and wanted to make the donation to the Hunter School and stuff like that. I couldn't get through. That's all I had was a whole bunch of rings on the other end.
Oh,
called in your program. And it came down to where I thought I was talking to Louise, and then all of a sudden Louise called up to the Hunter School. Hunter School called me back, and the whole thing is where I got to be able to take make my donation.
Oh, isn't that sweet? Yeah, it's you know, it's a small organization, and you know, the people there work really, really hard, and they're all wearing six hats at once, and sometimes the phone does. In fact, it's such a small organization it doesn't have a full-time person who answers the phone. You know, if you call the Hunter School, the phone will probably be answered by the executive director or, you know.
No, it's where it finally came down to where Kimberly called me back. It was great, you know. I mean, I tell you what, it's where, to be able to help the kids out, it's where, I had a problem pass and, it wasn't quite so perfect like a whole bunch of other kids. And,
yep.
I'd like to be able to take and say that, if I ever hit the lottery, they've got two brand new four-wheel drives. Going to come to them.
Wouldn't that be sweet? Rob, thank you so much for making a contribution to the Hunter School, hunterschool.org, and for calling.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Good talking with you, and greetings from Louise. Happy holidays. Louise was answering phones yesterday here. She's not in today, but Danielle is answering phones today. But Danielle was running the video yesterday. We're a small organization here, too. We all wear a lot of hats because Jim had to go. One of his kids was in a play. Yes, and so Jim, who normally does our video, was watching one of his son or one of his daughters in a play, and Katie, oh yeah, one of his daughters, his youngest daughter, and so Danielle was running the video, and Louise was answering the phones, and that's it's like family. Susan in Bellingham, Washington, which is sweet, and thank you, Shano and Jim and Danielle. Susan.
Hello, Tom.
And also thank you to Sue Nethercutt in the chat room, and Nigel Peacock, who does our web work, and Jamie Holly, and we've got a great family here. Susan, you're on the air. Pardon my interruption.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I feel doubly blessed not only to hear you get excited about things, but also to hear Marianne Williamson, because I have trouble changing from those two things. When I'm with my clients, I think I'm empathetic and caring. But when I get into politics, man, I can get mad.
Are you a physician or a therapist?
Yes, I'm a psychiatric social worker. My husband is a psychologist. We've run our own little thing for 30 years.
Well, that's wonderful.
It is wonderful, except that private insurance is getting worse and crazier every day.
Oh, are you paid by insurance companies?
Yes. Yes, sort of.
Yeah.
That's what I called to talk about.
Are you ripped off by insurance companies? That should be the question.
Well, they keep changing. First of all, the person will say, this client's covered 100%. And then they will say, but there's a copay and there's coinsurance. And they used to call this a deductible. And the deductible could be any place from $1,000 to $8,000 a year, which basically meant these people had no insurance. And the other day this happened from a big casino, and it was a male, and he was going to work on anger problems. But he had, you know, no money. And so, yes, I gave him an appointment, but it had to be out a few weeks because to stay in business, you kind of have to balance this.
Yeah.
And it doesn't make me sad. It makes me furious.
Yeah, I understand. I think that there's a phrase for that. Isn't it called righteous anger?
It's like,
yeah, but it was good to hear Marianne Williamson talk about needing to blend the two of them.
Yes, bring passion.
But I was thrilled to hear you really laying out what Obama wasn't doing.
Yeah, and
I'm looking at you on the television, but of course I'm listening to you on the phone. And on the television right now, you look really sweet. And
thank you. I'm a reasonable guy, but damn it, I'm upset. Okay, Susan, thank you for the call. You've said your piece, right?
Right.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate the call. Thank you so much. Brett in Dahlonega, Georgia. Oh, Dahlonega. I've been through Dahlonega. Hey, Brett, what's up? You are seriously thinking of moving to Canada?
I am. I can't believe I'm even thinking of it, but I am so despondent over the state of America, and I want my children. I have a 4 and a 5 year old, and I've got 2 15-year-olds and a 19-year-old Marine. But this last shooting has really, really affected me.
Yeah.
And that, on top of the disparity between the rich and the poor, I don't know what else to do. And realistically, if things aren't going to change, and I don't see them changing anytime soon.
Well, Brett, as long as people like you don't show up at your local Democratic Party meeting and say, I want to be a precinct committee person, I want to be part of the change that's happening here. And the Green Party, the Republican Party, the Libertarian Party, whatever. I really think that the lever, the pressure point that we can use the most effectively is probably the Democratic Party. And I'm not saying that because I'm a Democrat. Because arguably I'm not. I'm not sure what I am, politically. But I think that that's a pressure point. And people like you need to show up and get inside and change it. And I mean, that's how Canada became Canada. Citizens.
Well,
we have citizens-run government.
Right. I write my senators and congressmen. I call them. I do what I can. But do you think let's say we all do everything we can. Do you really realistically see the country moving down that path of single-payer health care, tighter gun legislation, higher minimum wage?
I actually do. I'm very hopeful. With regard to single-payer health insurance, you have two states, Vermont and Missouri, or Montana, rather, Vermont has already enacted it into law. Montana is seriously considering it. Governor Schweitzer is pushing really hard for this. And I think that and Obamacare will allow for this to happen. And I think in 2016, maybe it's 2014, you can get a state can get a waiver and do their own single payer health care system. And that's how it happened in Canada. Saskatchewan put into place a single payer health care system back in, I think it was 1956 or something like that. And within a couple of years, every other province looked at that and said, hey, that's kind of cool. Let's do that here. And now it's national. It's administered in each state by the state, and which is the way that Bernie Sanders thinks is best, and he's convinced me that he's right, that if each state administers its own single-payer health care system, then all the states will have an opportunity to look at what everybody else is doing and tweak things until they're optimal. And eventually you'll come to a point where you basically have a national standard, and then the federal government can adopt some of those standards as the Canadian government has done. But I'm very optimistic about that. I think that something's going to be done about gun control. I think it's going to be done incrementally, but it's going to it's going to happen. The biggest problem that we have, frankly, in my opinion, Brett, is that we have too much money in politics. And to get that out, we're going to have to do one of two things. We're either going to have to amend the Constitution of the United States, or one of the five right-wing cranks on the Supreme Court is going to have to retire, leave the bench, and have a replacement put into place by President Obama in the next 4 years, or a Democrat after him. And if we can get back the Supreme Court, if we can go back to the kind of sanity that we saw in the Warren Court, which, by the way, was a majority Republican appointees, oddly enough. But if we can get back to the kind of sanity that we had in previous Supreme Courts that never would have said, oh, yeah, money is speech. Corporations, they're people.
the right to own guns? Yeah, that's an individual right. I mean, these are all doctrines that have come about in the last 3 years. That's how insane this court is. So go to movetoamend.org, join the organization, start a local branch there in Dahlonega, Georgia, and, you know, invite some folks over to your house and have a conversation about it. Brad, I got to run, but thank you for the call. Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
See, I'm not in despair about this at all. I mean, I may sound pretty upset, but I'm not in despair. If I was in despair, I wouldn't be here. I think we can do it.
I read the news today, oh boy, about a lucky man who made the grave.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And speaking of the news, the Talk Radio News Service is brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, where you can give a goat to help a rescued slave, or you can give a crystal heart made by women recovering from the effects of war in South Sudan at GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Bob Ney is with us, reporting for the Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Bob.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. It's great to hear your voice. I hope all is well with you. So what's going on in the world?
Well, you know, we'll start with the gun issue. The president, as we know, has had his press conference, and he's giving a 30-day task with the vice president to coordinate some facts and finds and suggestions that come back to him. You're seeing people like, just to use a name, Jack Kingston, Republican congressman from down in Georgia, who's extremely conservative on Second Amendment issues, who's saying, hey, you know, let's also include discussions of that and also with mental health issues, and he's picking up video violence. But at least you're seeing, instead of a no, you're seeing, you know, some people beginning to say, I think due to the, you know, severe nature of what horrible thing happened, some discussions that will be underway within the month.
I have a question for you, Bob.
Yes.
It's not often I get an opportunity to ask somebody who was a big shot member of Congress, you know, about how Congress works and how people are thinking.
Sure.
And by the way, you used to live in the same arena we do. We ran out of water this morning.
Oh my! Okay,
we're on winter water,
winter water.
And our tank gauge didn't work, and we thought we had water, and we didn't.
Oh yeah,
like right in the middle of the shower. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. Anyway, this has been a weird day. I got to sleep at 2 o'clock this morning. I think I'm running. I'm sleep deprived. Anyhow. President Obama is debating with the Republicans how much to give billionaires in the tax cuts and how much to cut from retired people and disabled GIs and disabled people by cutting Social Security. Why is he engaging in a debate entirely within the confines of Republican talking points instead of saying, oh, yeah, I get it, Boehner, you want to do these things, but here's what I want. I want card check. I want anybody to be able to join a union by signing a card. I want to raise the minimum wage to $10 an hour so that we'll stimulate the economy and increase our tax collections. I want to not just roll back the Bush tax cuts. I want to roll back the Reagan tax cuts because America worked better when the top tax rate was over 70%. I want to lower the retirement age from 65 to 62 to knock 1 million seniors or 3 million seniors out of the workforce so that that 3 million jobs will open up for young people and there'll be more, you know, there'll be better paid jobs and it'll tighten the labor force and we'll raise tax collections. I could go on. You know, I've got a list here of about 20 of these things. Why is he not doing those things?
You know, and I'm not a person who dislikes the president by any stretch of imagination, but he's debating himself. In a sense.
Well, he's debating himself as if he was a Republican.
Yeah, and I say he's debating himself because he's having this conversation within basically the talking points of the Republican side. You know, Boehner, it baffled me at first why he's doing this move, but he's taking away pressure. Grover Norquist, all of a sudden, guess what, this afternoon? He came down from the mighty mountain and said, I'm giving you all a pass on this thing. So now some of the pressures... the leverage the president had on Boehner is not going to be, you know, really there as much. And the president's throwing out so much, and I thought, well, maybe it's because he really, really wants a deal to save this fiscal cliff. But I don't think that's the case. I think that the president is just trying to, you know, go in some direction to, you know, cut a deal as fast as he could on this at the risk of not putting out his vision and his his package that he wants and, you know, push for that. Hey, there's a compromise in between somewhere.
Yeah, I think both sides, both the Democrats and the Republicans, think that if they can cut a deal that everybody will applaud them for it. And I don't think that America's in the mood for compromise right now. I think people want to get things done.
They want to get it done. And, you know, if it goes over the fiscal cliff, maybe people can actually get some type of real change.
I'm with you. I'm all for calling their bluff.
That's what that, if I was there, I would be absolutely inclined to do that. And I've said this in a little commentary I made about a week or so ago. Let it go over the fiscal cliff and do it the right way with the discussions of the points you've talked about, because that is an effect on the economy.
Yeah. Absolutely. All those things that I talked about would have fiscal
consequences.
I don't get
this one. It's posturing.
Yeah,
it
seems to be. Mm-hmm. Okay, and with regard to Gover Nerquist, I think that's sort of like saying, I'm going to step out of the way of this bus, and then I'm going to claim credit for the fact that the bus went down the street.
Exactly.
You know?
I mean, that's awfully, benevolent of Gover.
Yes, right.
Wave his hand in the sign of the cross, and I'm a Catholic, but in the sign of the cross and say, you're dispensed.
There you go.
Yeah.
So what else is going on in the world, Bob?
Benghazi, I was surprised at the swiftness of three resignations of three top people in the State Department.
Mm-hmm.
I was a bit surprised that coming so quickly. I don't know if that's to defuse the situation, but Libya also, it's slighted for its the militia and it's not being prepared. Hillary Clinton's trying to make 29 changes within the State Department. She got a little bit, you know, hit that she was faking this, but luckily it came from John Bolton. Who's, you know, the raving lunatic of leftover.
Not taken quite so seriously.
Yes. And so luckily it came from there. And that's all I need to say about that one, I guess. But but she is taking steps to correct this. A lot of problems with the report that came out. And the gun issue. Those are the three big issues today on the Hill.
Yeah.
And there are some other D.C. news, too. The FCC is talking about, and this is a media thing, Tom, but eliminating that ban on cross ownership in the 20 big media markets, so you know the biggies can buy this and maybe a couple of TV.
This is a big sweet kiss to Rupert Murdoch,
isn't it? Though
it's so that he can buy the Los Angeles Times and the Chicago Tribune.
Yeah, and they initiated this on their own.
The Democrats did?
No,
or the FCC did? Yeah, but the FCC is majority Democrats, right?
I don't think anybody gave them an order to, but they, except maybe Rupert.
You think Julius Genachowski is looking at a job at, working for Rupert at $1 million a year next year if he retires?
As long as they haven't moved to London.
Yeah.
Over there.
Really. I suspect the revolving door is involved in this, and we should close.
That's correct.
You think I'm right?
I think something initiated this.
Yeah.
It wasn't the White House.
Very interesting.
Yes.
Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. Brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Up next, we're going to have an hour-long conversation with Conversations with Great Minds with Timothy Noah about inequality.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And we're every week now, we're doing these new Conversations with Great Minds segments on radio as well as on television. And our guest this week for our Conversations with Great Minds segment is Timothy Noah. He's a journalist, senior editor at the New Republic, and author of an absolutely brilliant book. If you don't have it, you should get it. If you haven't read it, you must read it. It's called The Great Divergence, America's Growing Inequality Crisis, and What We Can Do About It. His website is timothynoah.com, spelled all the normal ways you would expect. And I'll be talking with Timothy here for the first segment or so, and then at some point we're going to open the phone lines for your calls. So the calls, if you've called about something else, my apologies, call back tomorrow. But if you have a call to this topic, feel free to give us a shout. So, Timothy Noah, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. Tell us, what is the Great Divergence?
The Great Divergence is an increase in income inequality that began in 1979 and continues to this day. Some people think that, you know, growing income inequality is the way of capitalism. But in fact, from the early 1930s, through the late 1970s, incomes in the United States either grew more equal or remained stable in relation to one another. I'm talking here about the relationship between middle-class incomes and the incomes of the wealthy. There was some convergence between those two groups in terms of income from the 30s through the 70s, but a divergence began in 1979. We've seen a growing gap between middle-class wages and the wages of the affluent.
Yeah. By the way, if you, my volume coming back to you, if you could turn that down just a little bit. I think your microphone is picking up a little bit of, well, maybe not, because I'm not hearing myself right now. Okay, I think it must have been your phone sitting next to a microphone.
Moving my phone a little bit. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So from 47, from the 1940s, from the post-World War II era, from the end of World War II, until, you know, the Carter administration, basically, and in a big way, the Reagan administration, everybody's boat was being lifted. The tide was coming up. America was growing. Everybody was getting wealthier. What happened?
Well, quite a few. There wasn't one single cause. There were a number of causes. There's one very simple cause that explains part of the story. Part of the story is the 1% versus the 99%. That's what the Occupy Wall Street protests are all about, of course. And that was driven by the financialization of the economy, deregulation of Wall Street, movement of investment banks from partnerships to corporations, and runaway CEO pay. So that's
now, these were all the outcomes of legislation, were they not? Changes in tax code, changes in corporate law?
Yes, mostly the doing of government. The movement of investment banks from partnerships to corporations was not instituted by government, but it was encouraged by the regulatory environment.
Right.
So that's the simple part of the story. The more complex part of the story concerns the growing gap between skilled labor and low or moderately skilled labor, highly skilled labor and low or moderately skilled labor. And there you have multiple causes. One very significant cause, which will be familiar to a lot of people who've been following the news lately, was the decline of the labor movement. You know, the idea that a state like Michigan, where the modern labor movement was born, would adopt a right to work law, which in essence is a law that robs labor unions of union dues. The idea that that could happen, well, that would have been impossible 30 or 40 years ago, or even 20 years ago, I think. Private sector unionization has been in steep decline since the 80s, and it was declining at a more gradual rate starting in the early 1950s. It peaked in the early 1950s when we had about 40% of the workforce covered by union negotiating.
Now, this beginning of the fall of organized labor, wasn't that the echo of Taft-Hartley in 1947?
Taft-Hartley, yes. It was kind of a slow-acting poison on the labor movement.
Yeah.
Which
allowed states to become right-to-work-for-less states and opt out of all the provisions of the Wagner Act and therefore...
That was one thing it did. It also, you know, we had a battle over card check a couple of years ago that wouldn't have been necessary if the Taft-Hartley hadn't been passed back in the late 40s.
Right.
It weakened labor unions in a number of ways. And so, you know, private workforce went from 40% union to today it's about 7%. Union. So the labor movement has really been eviscerated. Whenever I hear anybody use the term big labor, it feels like a cruel joke to me.
Yeah.
There's nothing big about labor today, certainly not in the private sector anyway.
Right.
So that's part of the story. Another important part of the story is education. The high school graduation rate leveled off in the 1970s, and for the first time, the United States was not increasing its supply of skilled labor relative to demand, which grew and grew and grew through the 20th century as technology became more sophisticated. The early part of the century, we saw the advent of electricity and all sorts of other technologies, but the high school graduation rate was climbing fast. As of 1900, the overwhelming majority of Americans didn't go to high school.
So by the Reagan administration, basically it flattened out. Why? Is that because Reagan was the first president to put a guy into the Department of Education, Bill Bennett, who thought that education, public education, should be done away with?
No, I don't think that that's, I'm not sure that's what Bennett's position was then. I don't know what his position
was. It was. He campaigned for president on it, on ending the Department of Education.
On ending, did he want to end public education?
He wanted to end all federal funding. He wanted to end the Department of Education. Yeah.
I don't know precisely what caused the problem in education. I think it's, I think there are multiple factors. We could have a whole discussion just about the problems of K-12 education in this country.
Right.
Also the college completion rate has not kept up with the college completion rate in European countries. That one is a little more straightforward. At least part of that is caused by the growing cost of attending colleges. Colleges have become a luxury item. There are a number of colleges that provide generous financial aid, but there are a number of other colleges that don't have much money for financial aid. Mm-hmm. And so it can be difficult if you're low income to pay for college. So those were factors. Other factors, trade and outsourcing, have been smaller factors relative to labor and education. But they've been factors, particularly starting in the 21st century. Before the 21st century, trade really didn't figure very much in the story. But with the rise of trade with China, a huge country with very low wages, that really did put downward pressure on U.S. manufacturing wages. So those are a few of the causes.
Mm-hmm. And to that extent, to the extent that there was government policy involved with that, first of all, we had tariffs that averaged around 30% from the founding of the country until the 80s. Now they're around 2%. But the Chinese also were aggressively changing their policies. Let me get your take on that right after the break. We're talking with Timothy Noah. He is the author of The Great Divergence, an extraordinary book. And the subtitle is America's Growing Inequality Crisis and What We Can Do About It. We're going to get to what we can do about it in our Conversations of the Great Mind segment.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And Timothy Noah's website is timothynoah.com if you want to check it out. Be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Timothy Noah is our Conversations with Great Minds guest this week. He is a journalist, the senior editor at The New Republic. He's the author of a book, The Great Divergence, America's Growing Inequality Crisis and What We Can Do About It. And Timothy, you've done a brilliant job, both in the book and so far on this program in laying out this kind of increase in inequality or collapse in equality in the egalitarian nature of our society. The second half of the subhead of your book is, and what we can do about it. So what can we do about it?
Well, there are a number of things we can do. Some of them are politically plausible today. Some aren't, but I argue in the book we need to start at least talking about them. Mm-hmm. One idea that I thought was really outrageous when I wrote it in the book turned out a month or two later not to be so outrageous. Before the book was even published, President Obama was calling for, in effect, price controls on college tuition increases. He didn't put it quite so bluntly as I do in my book, but in the State of the Union address in January 2012, he put colleges on notice that if they cannot keep a lid on tuition increases, then the government will use the considerable leverage it has to make them do so. So that's one area. I
think why not do what Thomas Jefferson did in founding the Free University of Virginia, what Abraham Lincoln did in founding the land grant colleges across the United States, what three generations of governors of California did up until the Reagan governorship, and simply make college free?
Well, I would be all for that. I think state governments are moving in the opposite direction. They're defunding their universities, and of course it's especially heartbreaking to see what's happening in the California system. I mean, that is a public university system that has been the envy of the world, and it's suffering very badly these days.
Indeed.
So
that's one solution. One solution is stabilize it.
No matter who's paying for it, we have to get some sort of control over these costs. I think there's been very little consideration given to that part of the story. You know, the highest paid, last time I checked, the highest paid university president in the United States was the president of Ohio State. He makes like $2 million a year.
Wow.
That's outrageous, I think, at a time when people are struggling to pay for college.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And that's not even a for-profit college.
No.
I mean, I was thinking, let's ban for-profit colleges, and then you throw out a state university, it's like, whoa. Okay, so education, that's one. What else can we do about it?
Well, we need to revive the labor movement. I think that's hugely important. It's probably the most difficult challenge of all the things I suggest in my book. But, you know, there's one interesting idea that's been suggested, and that is to get the right to organize defined under the Civil Rights Act as a civil right. You'd have to amend the Civil Rights, the 1964 Civil Rights Law. Right now, it is theoretically a right we all enjoy to join or create a union in our workplace, but it's not a right that is defended very vigorously. It's even been suggested that the penalty for violating it is so small that it's economically irrational for employers to follow the law.
But,
that would change if the right to organize were put under the civil rights law. For one thing, if my boss fired me for joining a union, I could take him to federal court.
Yeah. What you're describing, you realize, both with, you know, making public education, college education very available and affordable, and by establishing the right to unionize, is basically what you have in most of the developed European, well, most of the developed countries around the world, Australia as well. But here, our Supreme Court has decided that we have an absolute right to own a gun, but we don't have a right to health care, education, or pretty much anything else, it seems.
Right, and practically speaking, these are all things we used to have in our society that have been slipping away. I would also call for re-regulation of Wall Street. I'd call for breaking up the big banks. And I would call for more aggressive oversight on the part of corporate boards of CEO pay, and anything the government could do to encourage that, I'd be in favor of. One provision in the Dodd-Frank law was the say-on-pay provision, which allowed stockholders to pass judgment on the pay packages of the corporations that they hold stock in. They can vote it down. It's not a binding vote, but it's a public relations humiliation for a company. It happened at Citibank last spring, and it was the lead story in the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of public pressure is good. More.
Although the CEO is Jamie Dimon, isn't it?
Pardon me?
That's Jamie Dimon, isn't it?
Citicorp Jamie Dimon. I think. Thank you.
Well, whoever it is, I'm guessing he didn't cut his pay as a consequence of the stockholder saying he should.
That's right, but I'm also guessing he wasn't very happy to see that as the lead story in the New York Times the day it appeared.
I'd take a bad story in the New York Times in exchange for $20 million any day.
Well, we're talking about cumulative pressure here. Yeah. We're talking about the beginnings of a movement.
I understand
of that movement. you know, I've also talked about creating a WPA, a public works program that would employ, put people on the federal payroll. I think there's real doubt about whether the private economy is going to provide sufficient jobs.
So you're suggesting the employer should be, or the government should be the employer of last resort.
That's right.
Yeah. That's very interesting. We're talking with Timothy Noah. We'll be taking your calls for Timothy Noah after the break here at the bottom of the hour. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. Timothy is a journalist. He's the senior editor of the New Republic. And he's the author of a book, a brilliant book, called The Great Divergence, America's Growing Inequality Crisis, and What We Can Do About It. Mr. Brown.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And you can check out Timothy Noah's work at timothynoah.com. We'll be right back with more with Timothy Noah. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with us, with you. It's our Conversations with Great Minds Hour for the week. Timothy Noah is with us. He is a journalist, the senior editor of the New Republic, the author of the book, The Great Divergence, America's Growing Inequality Crisis and What We Can Do About It. And Timothy, we have a number of people that want to talk to you on the telephone. Before we get to that, is there anything, any point that you would like to make in general or about the book or about the times that we are living in that we haven't discussed, or you know, something that I haven't brought up that should have been?
Well, I just would comment. You were reading the news earlier, and about the strange bargaining position that Democrats seem to be taking on the fiscal cliff. Something similar is going on with negotiations about the filibuster, and I wrote about both of these things today. The Democrats seem to be in the process of giving up on any really meaningful filibuster reform. And in both cases, we're seeing Democrats who were actually looking pretty tough for a while, possibly reverting to wimpy form, I'm afraid. And it's disappointing to see.
Yeah, disappointing is not quite a strong enough word. It's enraging! It's not going to help them in 2014, I'll tell you that.
Democrats don't seem to understand, you know, the exercise of power. They seem to be a little bit afraid of it.
Yeah, it's more
holding
of
all the cards in both situations.
And, yeah, it's more of a can't we all get together situation. Let's pick up some phone calls here. Brian in Denver, Colorado, listening on AM 760. You are on the air with Timothy Noah.
I was wondering what your view is of how SSDI and SSI increases are measured in terms of the real cost of living. Given we didn't have an increase from about 2008 till up until 2012. In other words, I'm including that there was an increase in 2012, especially given that that seems to be perhaps something on the table to lower.
This is SSDI, of course, being Social Security Disability Insurance, SSI Social Security Insurance. Timothy, your thoughts?
I don't know whether those are included in the proposal. There's a proposal to chain cost of living increases for Social Security, and I don't know whether it includes those parts of Social Security or not. In general, I will say that this process of chaining, I think, is it's just a benefit cut disguised as a technical fix. The theory is that, you know, people go out every day, they go shopping, and if cheddar cheese has gotten too expensive, they'll buy Swiss cheese, or if beef has gotten too expensive, they'll buy chicken. And if that change in shopping habits becomes permanent, then after a couple of years, that'll get incorporated into the market basket that's used to calculate cost of living increases. But if it's temporary, it will never be accounted for. And consequently, the Bureau of Labor Statistics has this very complicated alternative way of calculating cost of living increases that takes into account those substitutions. And I may add, not every substitution is necessarily as neutral as chicken for beef. I mean, you might have, in an extreme example, you could have, you know, dog food for regular food. I mean, you know, it doesn't measure a decline in the standard of living. Nonetheless, they argue that this technical fix is justified by behavior of shoppers. The problem is that the elderly, who constitute most Social Security recipients, have a very different market basket. A big part of their market basket is medical costs, which, of course, are increasing much faster than everything else. So a number of people said, hey, if this is really about making a technical fix, a true technical fix would increase cost of living benefits, not decrease them. So it's all a bit of a con, and what it really is a benefit cut.
Isn't there also something built into there where, for example, in calculating the cost of living adjustment, the inflation adjustments for Social Security, they have technology. So I think it was Senator Sanders told me. First of all, he said that this chain CPI not only will affect disability insurance, but it will also affect disabled veterans, 3 million disabled vets, because their income is tied to SSDI. Mm-hmm. And he's quite outspoken about that. In fact, he issued a press release about it today.
A disabled person would be presumably in the same situation as an elderly person would be spending money
that's
out
right.
of pocket.
But there's also this technology thing where they've been looking at this and saying, oh, look at computers have gone from, you know, $3,000 to and for 256K to $2,000 for a megabyte, to $1,000 for a gigabyte, and so they've gotten cheaper and they've gotten more powerful, and so we have to adjust the cost of living to reflect the fact that technology is getting cheaper and cheaper, when in fact most seniors are not buying a new computer every year, but as you point out correctly, they are buying medications and they are buying food and housing, which is not getting cheaper.
Right, right. I don't know the details about how they calculate the market basket, but certainly, the big point is this is not a technical fix. This is a benefit cut disguised as a technical fix. Now, in general, when you talk about income inequality, one argument that conservatives make is that people don't need as much money as they used to because food is cheaper and clothes are cheaper. And electronics are cheaper. And that's all true. But conservatives never want to talk about the rest of the story, which is that there are also a lot of things that are a lot more expensive. Cars are a lot more expensive than they used to be. And I'm talking about after inflation now. Houses are a lot more expensive. And, of course, most important, medical care is a lot more expensive.
Right. Patrick in Clinton, Maryland, watching on Free Speech TV. You are on the air with Timothy Noah.
Mr. Nolan, I wonder your thoughts on – hello.
Yes.
I wonder your thoughts on the legislation that was enacted that allowed these corporations to move offshore to China and India, giving them tax breaks, and how that has led to our income inequality and why we, the workers, haven't demanded that we get our – if not our jobs back, at least the tax revenue back.
Well, I think you're right. That probably has contributed to income inequality. I don't know how much it's contributed to income inequality. Probably not very much, but there is certainly a legitimate question to be asked about why are we subsidizing companies that move jobs offshore. President Obama talked about it during the election. Maybe after all this fiscal cliff business is worked out, we'll see the administration moving to propose legislation.
Okay.
I think particularly if there's a reform of the corporate tax, that'll have to be part of the discussion. I'm not sure that there will actually be a change in the corporate tax.
Yeah. Noah in Madison, Wisconsin, you are on the air with Timothy Noah.
Hi, good to be with you. I don't know where to start. I try to be active. I try to educate people about the issues of the day, what I learn on Free Speech TV, what I learn from the books I read. I read Unequal Protection. I'm reading right now the history, the untold history of the United States. I've read hundreds of books, maybe thousands of books in my life. Everybody just seems so discouraged that I talk to. Either they seem discouraged, like, oh, what can I do? You're fighting against powers that can't be beaten. So I'm just going to try to do things that make me happy and forget about the current situation of our global political environment. or they say, or they think, well, I have a lot of conservative evangelicals in my family. They just think my ideas are just flat out wrong. And I'm wondering, as somebody who's on Social Security disability for mental illness, whether I'm not doing harm to this people's movement by being associated with it, because they just look at me and say, well, he's crazy and we don't have to listen to him. Why aren't people listening to people? Why aren't the people that have the ability to change things listening to common sense?
Yeah, Noah, these solutions seem so common sense and straightforward. Timothy, excuse me, echoing Noah's question, why isn't there just a simple common sense conversation going on in America about the things that you're suggesting?
Well, I think we could have it would be easier to have that conversation in Congress if we could get rid of the kind of structural obstruction that we have with the filibuster. You know, we could have passed global warming legislation if it weren't for the filibuster. We could have gotten the public option in healthcare. The filibuster is, I know it sounds boring, but it's a really significant reason. A really significant obstacle to all sorts of policy solutions that enjoy broad support in the country. You know, I don't think that that political action is futile. I think that we've seen, you know, a change as a result of politics. We might actually be seeing, have in fact, just entering a moment where we might see some gun control finally implemented. Unfortunately, the reason is this terrible tragedy in Newtown, Connecticut last week. But it does seem to have shifted the politics of the issue, and I would hope that grassroots groups take advantage of it. Pressing.
It seems like we have to hit bottom to get to come back. We'll be right back with more of Timothy Noah. He's the author of The Great Divergence, America's Growing Inequality Crisis, and What We Can Do About It. And he's answering your questions, your calls. We'll be right back, 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And Timothy's website, of course, TimothyNoah.com. And his book, The Great Divergence, available in all, you know, all the usual suspects. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Lydia in Tehachapi, California. Okay, you are on the air with Timothy Noah.
Yes, I had a question in regards to the analysis of the labor movement. I'm always very frustrated because historically we've measured it by shops organized and the total number that are full-time active members under a contract. With the transition from shops leaving the country, and specifically corporations targeting shops or factories where labor was strong and just shutting them down, regardless, it's the same thing like Hostess. It wasn't that it wasn't profitable. It just doesn't want to have a union. And so although we have a diminished number under union contract, the labor movement's force has to be recalculated, kind of like those in the 20s and the 30s. It wasn't the people under contract. It was the people who were active in social movement. And I'm wondering how he analyzes that in the context of labor as in this transformation.
Well, yes, you can't rebuild labor in the same form that it was built in the 1930s. We have a very different economy. As you say, we have an international economy. You know, one thing that's been talked about is internationalizing labor. Corporations operate globally, so labor unions will have to operate globally as well. That's a tall order, but it's, I think, necessary. It's a necessary goal. you know, so yes, the kind of labor movement that we have in the future, I think, will look quite different from what we've had in the past. It will reflect changes in our economy. But I think we really need to begin some hard thinking about how to rebuild it.
Eric in Springfield, Illinois, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. You're on the air with Timothy Noah.
Yeah, how you doing, Tom? I've been listening to Mr. Noah's your program, and I'm trying to figure out here if, not have read the book at all, if the history of the decline of the manufacturing in this country is being explained. I mean, growing up in the Midwest, I've seen the demise of towns like East St. Louis, who was a manufacturing city for many years. After World War II, some of the older manufacturing facilities weren't repaired. There was a slight stoppage during the Vietnam War. But then after Vietnam, at a rapid pace, our manufacturing died. And it was in the 80s, it was finally brought out that a lot of our places have been shipped overseas and things of that nature.
So, Eric, your question.
My question is, every time I hear one of these things, it always starts with the middle class, okay? The workers, okay, from
your,
the factory
your question.
Are very rarely mentioned in any of these things, and it started long before this. So I just don't understand, you know.
Okay.
I'm having a hard time understanding.
Okay.
The explanation.
Eric, let's toss this to Timothy Noah. Your thoughts, Timothy, on Eric's comments? And
well, yes.
When did the real decline of the middle class?
Steeply, but it's interesting to compare what happened in the United States versus what happened in Germany. I mean, the thing about globalization is it affects countries around the world, right? It should affect comparable nations in Europe. The same way it affects us. But if you look at Germany, they managed to maintain a very significant manufacturing sector by retooling and going after very high-skilled manufacturing.
Well, they also maintain a VAT tax that they aggressively use as a functional tariff. If you want to import something into Germany, you have to add about 18% of the cost of it. If you want to export something from Germany, you get about an 18% discount. That's, you know, a 35%, 36% spread there that's, you know, in the neighborhood of where our tariffs used to be.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that issue per se, but certainly there are, in general, one can say it is not, you know, Germany is an advanced industrial democracy like we are, and they have managed to hang on to their manufacturing sector. Yeah. But it's a different kind of sector than ours. It's emphasis. They're not participating in the race to the bottom.
Yeah.
They are not trying to compete with third world countries that can provide extremely cheap labor. They're trying to take advantage of the education level of their workers.
Okay, we have just a minute left. I'm seeing on the board calls the people who are making decisions to cut our benefits. What are their benefits? Is there a way people can buy your book and send it to the president or Congress? What about filibuster reform? Nonpartisan redistricting, would that help solve the problem? And did the Tea Party members get into Congress illegally? You want to take any of those or just riff on them?
Yeah, that's a lot. We talked about filibuster reform. You know, I will say my book is coming out in paperback on January 22nd.
Oh, great.
So I hope people will buy it for themselves at least. Redistricting, I'd have to look at the particular proposal.
Doing away with gerrymandering. Has anybody seriously had a serious conversation about ending gerrymandering?
I think it's pretty hard. I think it's like, you know, ending corruption.
Yeah.
But certainly the gerrymandering that's been done.
Yeah, there you go. Timothy Noah, timothynoah.com, the website, the book, The Great Divergence. Also, he's senior editor at The New Republic. You can read his work there. Timothy, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much, Tom.
It's great talking with you. Coming up next on the Tom Hartman Program, we'll have the latest in the so-called fiscal cliff negotiations, plus find out what you can do to help free America's political prisoner, Governor Don Siegelman. We'll have a conversation with Dana Siegelman of free-don.org. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up, when you participate. Get out there, get active, tag. You're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.